This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. There's a long history of physicists jumping fields and taking on key problems in biology. One such physicist joins us later this hour to talk about his unconventional education and what we might be missing in our interpretations of DNA, plus five books he says everybody should read at some point in their life. First, there are tens of thousands of people in the United States who have been diagnosed as being in a vegetative state, unresponsive and unaware of their surroundings. But some scientists say that 15 to 20% of those people are actually conscious, capable of seeing, hearing, and understanding all that's going on around them, just not able to make that known. The evidence comes from 25 years worth of brain scans. Adrian Owen was one of the first to rigorously question the consciousness of such unresponsive individuals. He's the Canada Excellence Research Chair in Cognitive Neuroscience and Imaging at the Brain and Mind Institute at Western University in Ontario. His new book is Into the Gray Zone: A Neuroscientist Explores the Border Between Life and Death. He joins me now via Skype. Adrian, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me on.
You've been working on this problem for 25 years. How many patients diagnosed as being declared vegetative have you put through some of your brain scans? And is it 15 to 20%? How many of them, according to your tests, are actually conscious in some way?
That's a great question. And it really, it depends on at what point in time you start. Obviously, very early on, almost 25 years ago now, we just started seeing one or two patients a year, putting them into scanners and asking. At that point, we weren't really asking whether they were conscious. We were just asking whether their brains could do anything. Was there anything left that could happen? So we would show them pictures or play them little stories and just try to activate their brain. And it actually wasn't until about 10 years ago that we really got going with the whole consciousness idea, the fact that some of these patients could be fully aware, and able to respond to tell us that they were aware and go on to even communicate in some cases. Now, over that 20-year period, I've seen many hundreds of patients, but of course they haven't all been through the communication and the consciousness scans.
Now, the first patient that you scanned was a young woman named Kate, who was declared to be in a vegetative state after a severe brain infection. At that point, you had been doing research and brain scans on healthy individuals. What actually made you think that first time to scan an individual who had been diagnosed as vegetative and, according to, you know, all doctors, was unaware and unresponsive?
I think there was a sort of a collision of different events. A year earlier, a former partner of mine had a brain aneurysm that had put her into a vegetative state. This was a rupturing of an artery in the base of her brain. And I don't think until that point I had even probably heard the term vegetative state before. We're talking more than 20 years ago now. And I had the expertise. I'd been working as a neuroscientist. I had brain imaging expertise. And Kate came along really not very long after that personal event in my life. And one of my clinical colleagues at the hospital I was working in the UK said, you know, why don't we put her in the scanner and see what happens? And frankly, everybody thought this was a completely mad thing to do at the time, that, she was vegetative, as my former partner was. What was the point? It was a waste of money. It was a waste of time. And I think, looking back, had Kate's brain not activated on that day in the way that it did, I wouldn't be here speaking to you today, because I would have probably given up and said, yep, they're all right. There's nothing there in these vegetative patients. But Kate's brain responded in the scanner almost exactly as yours or mine would when exposed to the same type of information.
At the time, you were acting pretty quickly. As you said, this was kind of an off-the-cuff idea, and you were actually worried that Kate might die, and you would miss the opportunity to do a scan on a patient in this state. Instead, she ended up recovering. You've kept in touch with her over a long period of time. What has she been able to tell you about her experience during that period where she was diagnosed as vegetative, when she was unresponsive, and about her recovery over time?
Kate is an amazing individual. As you say, she and I have been in touch mostly via email over the last 20 years or so. I last saw her when I was preparing the chapter about her for the book. I went to see her in Cambridge, and we sort of reflected on 20 years that we'd been on this strange journey together. And she continues to to tell me amazing things about recovery. I mean, one of the things that occurred on this visit 20 years later was that for the first time, Kate was talking again. So 20 years after her brain damage, she'd actually taught herself to speak again. And this is odd because it was the first time in that entire period that she and I had a real conversation, because of course we'd connected through the brain scanner 20 years ago. We've met on a number of occasions. She uses a sort of a letter board where she pointed to letters to communicate, spell out words. She can type and email, and that's the way we've been contacted since I've been in Canada. But now finally she was talking, and it just shows you know how long the recovery period can be for some of these patients.
You scanned another patient a few years later, Debbie. In that case, you were asking her to respond to speech instead of faces. And again, she was responsive. I mean, you seem to get very lucky that your first few patients that you tried to test actually responded positively. And again, she recovered. Do you think there's a connection that these patients who, while they're in a, you know, presumably or apparently vegetative state, their brains are actually conscious? Does that translate to a person who has the potential to recover or who does recover?
You make a very interesting point. I'm just going to pick you up on first about getting lucky, which I mean, I absolutely agree with you at one level. You know, I'm very lucky, and I've always been very lucky. But you know, this has happened too often to me over the course of this scientific journey that, you know, the questions we ask the patient, either the first or one of the first few patients, is the one that responds. And actually, what that tells me is not that I'm getting very lucky, but this is much more common than we previously thought. Much later on when we move on to other patients, I'll tell you about some patients here in Canada, show these sort of remarkable brain responses that one way of looking at it is, wow, you know, how did you get so lucky to run into that particular patient at that particular time? And, you know, I've come to realize that it's that this stuff is actually quite common, and these patients aren't that hard to find. They're in every town and in every country all over the world. I've actually forgotten what the second part of your question was. I'm sorry.
Whether this ability to respond while in an apparently vegetative state correlates in some way with their long-term prognosis and their likelihood of recovering from
yes,
the injury.
Absolutely, yeah. It certainly does. We've shown a study we published in 2009 in the journal Brain, showed that if you look at these responses, and I'm not necessarily talking about the very high-level responses, sometimes even very basic responses to speech, as we saw with Debbie, but if you look at how those responses predict recovery, there is a significant correlation. So the more likely you are to be able to perform these tasks in our scanner, the more likely you are to have some form of recovery. And I guess that makes sense, because presumably the patients who aren't as severely impaired are the ones who are most likely to have some progress, but also those who are most likely to be able to generate these patterns of activity in the brain scanner.
You already alluded to this, but you know, seeing a response to photos of faces or even seeing a response to speech still left a question in your mind and in many of your colleagues' minds about whether or not this was a conscious response or whether it was just some automatic firing of the brain in response to a familiar stimulus. You eventually designed a test to test this idea. Are these patients conscious? And it centered around asking them to imagine playing a game of tennis. So please describe that test and how you ended up asking these apparently unresponsive patients to, while in a brain scanner, imagine playing tennis and what you learned from that.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. There are a number of, I think, quite amusing stories that I put in the book about the interactions I would have with my colleagues when I was doing these experiments in the early days. And, you know, showing Kate pictures of faces was a great example where, you know, I was so excited to see the so-called face area of the brain light up. I would run around showing all of my colleagues, and they all had exactly the same response, which was great, but is she conscious? And, you know, I sort of thought, oh, I don't know. And then the same thing with Debbie. You know, we played speech sounds, little stories, and we saw activation in the parts of her brain that were involved in processing speech. And I would run around and show all my colleagues, terribly excited, look, you know, this vegetative patient is responding. And they would say, yeah, that's really interesting, but is she conscious? And this is how I got into consciousness. It wasn't really through a want of, you know, a desire to get into that particular area of science. It was I gradually started to realize that's what people really wanted to know. They weren't particularly concerned about whether this part of the brain works or that part of the brain works. It was, is the person still there? And that's what they really mean by, is she still conscious? So in 2006, we designed the tennis experiment, which sounds very strange, but the background is actually very straightforward. We sat down and said, well, what would we have to do for us to be completely convinced that this person is conscious? And we basically went back to the drawing board and thought about how somebody, you know, an accident at the side of the road would do it. I mean, everybody's seen some sort of medical drama where, you know, the doctor says to the patient, squeeze my hand if you can hear me. And that sort of told us that, yeah, what you need is you need a response. You don't want something that could be automatic. You want a request followed by a response to that request. So this sort of pushes in the direction of, well, what could we get people to do with their brains that wouldn't necessarily be automatic? And this then led us to thinking of an imagery task. And one imagery task that just works very well is getting people to imagine vigorously waving their arms around, because this activates a part of the brain known as the premotor cortex, and that's the bit of the brain that sets up sequences of actions. If you were actually playing a game of tennis, your premotor cortex would be lighting up all the time, but it also does even if you just imagine playing a game of tennis. It's because you're thinking about moving your arms. We tried this on many healthy participants. We found it was exceedingly reliable. It was just like saying to somebody, squeeze my hand if you can hear me. We would say, imagine playing tennis if you can hear me. And the part of the brain involved in imagine playing tennis would activate. And again, as I alluded to earlier, the very first patient we tried this in, this was a vegetative patient who'd been that way for 5 months. We put her into the scanner and we said, imagine playing tennis. And it was one of those moments in one's career that don't come along very often, but her premotor cortex immediately sprang to life in exactly the same way that yours or mine would if I asked either of us to imagine playing tennis in the scanner.
That's Adrian Owen joining us via Skype. His new book is Into the Gray Zone: A Neuroscientist Explores the Border Between Life and Death. We'll talk more when Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Adrian Owen about his new book, Into the Gray Zone: A Neuroscientist Explores the Border Between Life and Death. The book tells the story of 25 years of cutting-edge research in terms of compelling personal stories. Adrian, you've actually put yourself in one of these brain scanners and found that some of the tasks that you are asking vegetative patients to perform are harder than you had realized. What was the hardest part?
I think imagining playing tennis in a scanner is actually quite hard, and it might seem trivial to people listening to this, but you know what we do? We ask people to do this for 30 seconds continuously, so you're not continually prompted. And this is actually key to the design of the study, really, because you know it's very easy to fire a gun, and a part of the brain will just automatically light up because your auditory cortex will just spring to life when you hear a gunshot, and that's not something that has much to do with your consciousness. But if I say to you, imagine playing tennis, there might be some immediate brain responses related to hearing words or, you know, hearing the sentence or even thinking a little bit about tennis. But if you were to be able to continually activate your brain for a full 30 seconds, you really have to be continually thinking about playing a game of tennis. And I would encourage anybody listening to this to try it. It's not terribly easy because your mind wanders. About 15 or 20 seconds in, you start to sort of lose interest and think about other things. So this, I think, underscores how amazing it was that these patients were able to do this at the time, because we were really asking them to do quite a cognitive feat. And of course, to replicate it, we didn't only do it once. We often would do it 10 times in a row. So 10 sessions of playing tennis in your head for 30 seconds. It's pretty demanding, I would say.
I mean, based on your research, you say that 15 to 20% of vegetative patients are actually probably conscious. But given how difficult it is to pass your test, I mean, is it more like asking somebody to lift weights if they hear you instead of just asking them to squeeze your hand? You know, is this task so difficult that perhaps there are more conscious individuals who are unable to perform that task?
I think that's a really great question, and it's one I have to be quite careful in how I answer, because you know, I'm completely with you on this, to be honest. I think we've set the bar very high, and we set the bar very high because we don't want to get it wrong. We don't want to be concluding that some patients who are not conscious are actually conscious, because I think that would be, that would be an extremely bad thing to do, both scientifically and clinically. So we set the bar very high, which means that when somebody does this, we can be absolutely sure that they are conscious. But when somebody doesn't do it, as you've said, we can't be sure that they're not conscious, because it just may be too effortful for them. They may not have heard the instructions. They may not even know what tennis is in some cases, in which case they're not going to imagine playing tennis. So we have to be very careful about drawing negative conclusions. And, you know, I agree with you. I think if we set the bar lower, we would probably find that more patients had some degree of awareness. But, you know, what does that mean? And my concern is really right now is identifying the patients who, you know, are pretty much intact, are pretty much locked in. And those, I think, are the patients who can imagine playing tennis. Saying that, as I describe later on in the book, we have been working on easier ways of reaching the same conclusions.
I mean, speaking about the medical ramifications for these actual patients, not just as scientific test cases, but as people who are receiving medical care, you say you wouldn't want to conclude that someone was conscious if they weren't. Maybe on a scientific basis, that's valid. But it would seem that in a medical setting, wouldn't we be better off assuming that more people were conscious? What would be the harm in doing that?
I think it would be wrong to give people unrealistic expectations, I think. I mean, in my experience of working with these patients, you know, I know that it's hard for families to appreciate always the difference between the condition that a patient is in and their likelihood of recovery, for example. And we do know, as I said earlier in this interview, that patients who do better in the scanner are more likely to recover. So if we were to, you know, lower our bar and start saying, well, there's more of these patients here, by extension, we're suggesting that they are more likely to recover. And I think that's probably unrealistic in many cases. A lot of our patients have been in a vegetative state for 10 years or more. And, you know, I don't think in those cases it's realistic, and nor would it be fair to give out any information that would suggest they had a better chance of recovery than they actually do.
Are these kind of scans that you're talking about, and it has shifted over the course of 25 years from PET scans to now functional MRI studies of these patients, but is this kind of scanning and diagnosis a standard of care, or is this something that individuals would have to seek out above and beyond what is commonly offered?
It is. It's the latter. It isn't standard of care. I mean, there are certain places in the world where various sort of physicians just decide, I guess they've read the literature and they've decided this might be a worthwhile thing to do in an individual patient, because I get a fair number of inquiries from around the world with people asking for specifics of exactly how to do the scans. But by and large, this isn't something that any of these patients are going to get just in the course of their care. I think we're moving in that direction. We've been publishing a few papers recently demonstrating how easy or otherwise it might be to do this using a sort of standard hospital magnet standard hospital MRI, as opposed to the sort of very high-end sophisticated research MRIs that we have available to us. And actually, the results look quite promising. With the tennis task, for example, we recently tried this in some healthy participants on a 19-year-old cheap and cheerful hospital MRI, and actually it worked just fine. So, you know, it can be done, and I think it's just a matter of time before this trickles down to become something that's more widely used clinically.
As you mentioned earlier, you can actually use your tennis test, the imagining tennis request, to communicate with people. You know, it's kind of the blink if you hear me, blink twice for yes. You instead ask people to imagine tennis if the answer is yes or if the answer is no. And you've used this to ask some patients if they are in pain or even if they would like to die. What would you do with that information if someone said yes?
Well, just to be clear, asking patients if they're in pain is something that we do fairly regularly now. Asking a patient whether they wanted to die is something that we actually only ever did once with the first patient we managed to communicate with. And the way that came about was that really because things just moved very, very quickly on the day, that we had no idea the patient was conscious, and within a few minutes we found out they were. The next day we put them back into the scanner and started to communicate, and they rattled through the first few questions we asked them. And in a way, I think we weren't ethically prepared for what we should do next. And a decision was made that was a reasonable question to ask on the day. Subsequent to that, I think we've pulled back a bit and taken a rather more philosophical view of this, and I think that's the right view, which is that I don't think you should ask these sorts of questions unless you absolutely know what you're going to do with the answer. We don't have an ethical framework in place for deciding what we would do if a patient were to answer, yes, I would like to die. Even though many people might think that information is very clinically useful and could be acted upon, again, the circumstances surrounding the death in most of these patients' cases are protracted legal cases. This is not a case of pulling the plug, because many of these patients are so-called chronic disorders of consciousness. They don't need to be kept alive with machines and things. They basically have to be fed and hydrated, but otherwise, they breathe unassisted, their heart beats unassisted, and they survive for many years like that. So, it's a big ethically challenging and legal question. Allowing them to die. And I think one really needs to know what you're going to do with the answers to questions before you ask them.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with neuroscientist Adrian Owen about his new book, Into the Gray Zone. Has doing this research changed your own personal views with regard to either right to life or right to die issues?
I don't know whether it's changed my views. I suppose I've had a lot of time to think about it. And these are sort of themes that I talk about in Into the Gray Zone, because those sort of implications, I know, are the ones that people are very interested in. So I spent a lot of time researching this and thinking about it. And I mean, I suppose my best answer to your question is it's made me realize that ultimately we are each best equipped to decide our own fate. And, one of the heartbreaking things in many of these cases is that at present, the next of kin or the substitute decision maker is the person that has to decide the future of a patient. And that's an extremely hard thing to do. It doesn't matter how well you know somebody, how much you love somebody, deciding whether they're going to live or die is absolutely the worst thing in the world. And I think wherever possible, if we can pull some of that responsibility back to the patient themselves. And this is really what we're working towards. If there's a patient who's conscious, there's a patient who can communicate, can they be the person that makes decisions about their future? Because it takes an enormous burden away from many other people in the equation. I'm sure we would all sleep much better at night if we knew that the patient was making their own decisions about their future.
Some of your early research actually focused on Parkinson's disease. And as you work your way back into the realm of on a research level, trying to essentially define what is consciousness, does that have impacts for the large number of patients who are not in a vegetative state because of severe brain trauma or an infection, but are suffering from these neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's or Alzheimer's?
It's interesting that really came back to me while writing the book. I mean, my PhD 25 years ago, at least, was on cognitive deficits, brain disorders in Parkinson's disease and in Alzheimer's disease. And I moved a short time after that into working with disorders of consciousness. But when I came to write the book, I started to think back to that early work. And I thought, well, something like Alzheimer's disease is a kind of a gray zone state, in the sense that so many things change about the person, their personality changes, their memory changes, their ability to interact with the world changes. And in many ways, they change fundamentally as a person. And that's a little bit you know, that's really what I mean by, you know, in the gray zone, which is, you know, is trying, is when a person gets into a situation where we don't really know whether they're the same person anymore. And I know a lot of people who have cared for people in the late stages of Alzheimer's disease, which can often evolve into a kind of vegetative state. You know, their central question is dad still there? You know, and the question they're asking there is the same one that we're asking in the vegetative state patients. Is the essence of the person, do they know who they are, where they are, and the situation they're in, and can they appreciate the that I'm here for them, and these sorts of things? And so, yes, I think it's very relevant to neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease. And I devote some parts of the book to discussing that issue.
This research has not always been easy for your colleagues to accept, and at some point in the book you actually talk about the emotional and psychological difficulty of thinking about this idea that someone who appears to be unresponsive and unaware might actually be fully conscious and essentially trapped and suffering because of that, that it's easier to think that these patients are simply vegetative. How well accepted is your research now, and do you see it making an impact on the standard of care and how both neuroscientists and medical doctors look at some of these patients?
I think the responses over the years to my research have been perfectly natural, really. You know, and I don't think it's tremendously different in this area than other areas I've worked in. So the natural course of science is you publish a scientific paper, and then people throw up their hands in horror often and say, that can't be true, I'm going to check it, and they go away and check it. And of course, you know, perhaps in this particular area, it's partly because of the media attention that it attracts, it's maybe been a little bit more obvious for people outside of the field to say, oh, hang on, that looks very controversial. People are really, you know, not ready to believe this yet. And I don't actually think it's terribly different to other areas that I've worked in. It's just that it attracts a lot more attention. But, you know, typically what's happened, and it's the case in this research as well, other people have done this. And there are certainly, if you take the tennis playing experiment, for example, you know, very quickly, colleagues of mine and peers of people working in similar areas in other countries of the world quickly started trying to replicate it and find other patients who could imagine playing tennis. And it was less than a few months before other reports were coming out of similar patients. And then very quickly, the doubt sort of dissipates and people go back to waiting for the next paper to come out that they can throw up their hands and say, surely that can't be true. And yeah, I mean, I probably get a bit more of it than most, but it's certainly, we're at a stage now where it is widely accepted that these patients exist, you know, and we're still arguing about exactly how many patients it applies to, and you know, and these, and what's the best technique for identifying them, and these sorts of things. But you know, the basic idea that patients, many of these patients, aren't what they appear to be and have residual consciousness, I think, is universally accepted now.
That's neuroscientist Adrian Owen. His new book is Into the Gray Zone: A Neuroscientist Explores the Border Between Life and Death. He joined us via Skype. Adrian, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. That was very enjoyable.
I'm Heather Goldstone. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.